now.
You're listening to the Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hey there, welcome to the Dr. Nina Show. I'm Dr. Nina Savelle Rockland. I am a psychoanalyst specializing in food, weight, and body image issues, and I'm here to help you break free of the diet trap and lose weight without dieting. That means no more counting calories, carbs, or fat grams, no more thinking about food all the time. It really is possible to lose weight and gain health all without ever going on another diet. So today, I'm going to talk about how to stop the sabotage when it comes to weight loss, but I'm also going to answer some of the questions that came in from you guys over the week and hopefully take some calls. So if you'd like to talk with me about anything related to food, weight, or body image, the call-in number is 818-602-4929. I don't have a call screener, so when you call, you get me directly. Again, that number, 818-602-4929. You can also tweet me at WinTheDietWar or email dr.nina@winthedietwar.com. So like I said, I got a bunch of messages from those of you who listened in last week, and I got one question a few times. So it's actually something I'm asked a lot, so I'm glad that a few of you asked me. So the question is, Dr. Nina, how do I tell the difference between physical hunger and emotional hunger? And it's a really good question because you can get so caught up in eating, overeating, binging, dieting, thinking about food, thinking about what you should eat, shouldn't eat, and all of that. You get totally disconnected from your body and from your hunger. So here are some signs that you are physically hungry. You might have some or all of them. Okay, number one, you have a growling, gurgling stomach. Of course, that always happens when the room is the most quiet, right? When you're in a meeting, boom. And number two, you feel lightheaded. Maybe you have a headache, especially if you haven't eaten for some hours. And pretty much any food sounds good because you just need to eat something at that point. So those are the signs of physical hunger. And here are some signs of emotional hunger. A specific food sounds good or looks good. You want to reward yourself. You want to calm down. You want to feel better. So if you're physically hungry, you just need to deal with that hunger. You just want it to go away. Anything will do. Emotional hunger is when you're using food to change the way you feel, to give you comfort, to calm you down, to celebrate, and that kind of thing. So emotional hunger is when you're using food to resolve something psychological instead of something physical. And here's another thing you can do to tell the difference. Just put off eating for 3 minutes and see what happens. So if you're like, oh, I have to have that donut or whatever it is, just say, okay, I can have it in 3 minutes, because 3 minutes is manageable, right? Now, if you're physically hungry, you'll probably get a little bit hungrier, but not so hungry that you'll totally lose control. If you're emotionally hungry, the urgency may pass in that 3 minutes and you can feel more reflective and less reactive. It may give you just enough time to figure out, hey, you know, what is eating at me? What purpose is this donut serving? Okay, so now the next question is from Amanda in New York. She asks, can you address how to take responsibility for our actions without it turning into self-blame? I'm taking responsibility and holding myself accountable for my health as I'm working really hard to make quote-unquote lifestyle changes to improve my blood pressure, lose weight, and avoid having to take any more medications. She says, I blame myself for not taking better care of myself for the past several years, which I know accomplishes nothing except making me feel worse than I already do, but I feel like I just can't let myself off the hook for all my mistakes that have gotten me to this point, or I'll keep making the same poor choices that will continue to negatively affect my health. Well, Amanda, I'm glad you recognize that you're beating yourself up, because you're definitely being hard on yourself. That is for sure. this kind of turning on yourself and being self-critical is at odds with self-care. If you're constantly berating yourself, you may even be turning to food to escape your mean critical voice. As I say, a lot of people in my groups and on my online programs are very familiar with this. It's so important to be curious, not critical. When you're critical, you just feel bad. When you're curious, you're more likely to get answers as to what's going on, really get to the bottom of it. So to answer your question, Amanda, it's important to distinguish between blaming and explaining. Blaming doesn't do any good, as you already know, and it just only makes you feel worse. It makes you feel terrible. So blaming sounds like, I should have taken better care of myself. I made poor choices. It's my fault. I'm in the situation. I did this to myself. Some version of, it's my fault, with some shoulds thrown in there. And, you know, the other thing I like to say is, don't should on yourself. Okay, explaining sounds like, I did not learn to soothe myself with words. I didn't know how to recognize and honor what was going on inside my head and my heart, and instead I used food to cope. Now I understand that there's another way to respond to myself, and I'm making new choices that are in the service of self-care. And I'm proud of myself for doing the difficult work of learning a new way to relate to myself and to food. Explaining is much more reasonable, isn't it? And it makes you feel a lot better, and it'll get you somewhere. Now, the other thing that I noticed, Amanda, is that you feel like you can't let yourself off the hook, otherwise you're just going to keep doing what you were doing. So a lot of people think that they motivate themselves by criticism, and this just is not true. Being hard on yourself is not motivating. Being supportive is motivating. Think about how you motivate your friends, your kids, other people. Do you keep them on the hook, as Amanda put it? You blame them for what's going on in their lives? Or do you motivate them with support and encouragement? Criticism is not motivation. Also, Amanda, I'm wondering where you learned to find fault and see the worst in yourself. If you were criticized as a child, or if people paid more attention to what you did wrong than what you did well, then you may have actually internalized that way of relating to yourself. So what do I mean by internalized? Okay, often what starts off as a dynamic between two separate people, you and someone else, and maybe that someone is a parent or a sibling or a teacher, some kind of significant person in your life, grandparent, aunt, someone. That relationship gets internalized. So what starts off between you and someone else becomes a dynamic between two parts of yourself, you and you, your critical self and you. As an example, I had a patient, let's call her Meg. Meg told me that when she was in the eighth grade, she got a report card, and it was all A's except for one C, just one C. And get this, this is the most crazy part of it. The C was in science, and it was for attitude. I don't know what kind of school she went to, but they not only graded you on your tests and in your academic performance, they graded you on your attitude. God, I would have so gotten an F in math. Can you get worse than an F? F minus. I would have gotten F minus in math. Anyway, so Meg got this great report card. Everything was A. But all her mom could talk about was that C in attitude in science. She basically ignored the A's. And what do you think happened when Meg grew up? She ignored all her achievements and only focused on her perceived mistakes or deficits. And although she hated it when her mom was focused on that C, all Meg did as an adult was look at the equivalent of the C. What she didn't do or what she didn't do well became much more important than what she actually did, what she accomplished. So Amanda and anyone else out there who tends to beat themselves up, ask yourself where you learned to be so hard on yourself. Are you treating yourself the way you were treated? And if so, here's what you need to do, one of the things you need to do to make a change. You have to process and work through that original wound. You have to grieve what happened and what did not happen. You have to go through that process of, you know, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, until you get to acceptance. And when you do that, you stop repeating the past by being hard on yourself. Like Meg, she was like, well, it's in the past, and my mom just, you know, she wanted the best for me. I don't want to blame her. Well, that's fine. And I'm, by the way, I'm not a fan of blaming parents. It just makes you a victim. But I am a fan of saying, let's explain how I developed this relationship to myself. And to say, you know what, when that happened, so Meg had to go through the, when that happened, that was really painful. It was really so hard to realize that my mom could only see that C. And it really crushed me. And she had to really process now as an adult what she didn't truly allow herself to process then. And when she did that, you know, she started being nicer to herself. So, often, by the way, I find that people treat themselves the way they were treated, but they treat other people the way they would have liked to be treated. So, all, you know, wow, you did great. Who cares about that C? You're wonderful. Look at all that you do to other people. But then to yourself, it's, oh my God, how could I have gotten that C? Okay, the call-in number, once again, is 818-602-4929 if you'd like to chat with me. 818-602-4929. You can also tweet me at Win the Diet War. Okay, here's a question from Dyla. Yeah, she said it looks like Dayla, but it's pronounced Dyla. So, Dyla, who is starting to KonMari her home, and for those of you who don't know about the KonMari method, it's a way of organizing. It's been quite a phenomenon when it comes to tidying and cleaning up your space. It's from this woman in Japan who's just revolutionizing home organization. So Dyla was starting to see a connection between the messy condition of her house and her emotions. And she wrote, "My home is cluttered and I've always been messy. I'm a bit fearful of what it would be like to live in a home that's not constantly calling out to me to do something, since I think that's been a distraction in my life. But I also know how much I love being in peaceful, tidy spaces and how that makes me feel better, and therefore I care for myself better, including food." And then she shared a memory about going out on a morning run. This was a long time ago. She used to run with some people on a regular basis. And she said, a guy was passing me, and this guy was usually very kind and encouraging, but this time he slowed down a bit and yelled, "You're not even sweating. It's supposed to hurt." And I thought, she said, "He's totally right. Why am I so afraid to work hard?" Oh, I have a call. I'm going to put a pause on that. Hold on. Hello, caller. Hello?
Hello.
This is Dr.
Hello.
Hello. This is Dr.
Hello,
Nina.
Yes.
Hi, who am I talking to?
Hi, this is Christina.
Hi, Christina. What's on your mind today?
I'm a second-time listener. This is your second show. First-time caller.
Well,
so
welcome.
I'm sorry if I'm a little bit nervous because I really don't usually call into radio shows, but I have read your book and really am fascinated by what you are talking about, which is not to focus on the food but to focus on the issues. And my question is, I am confused as to how you would define a binge, particularly living here in America. I'm from the South, and, you know, food is a big part of life. Sometimes I've been in family situations where we would eat all day, and I know it sounds like a strange question, but I have noticed that at night, probably for most of my life, I eat until I'm uncomfortably full and my stomach hurts. So how are you defining a binge? It seems obvious, but I'm now a little bit confused.
Christina, this is a great question, and don't be nervous. It's just you and me. We're just talking. It's fine.
Okay.
You know, I think that a lot of people think they're binging when they're not, and I want to first... I want to distinguish between overeating and binging. Everybody overeats at some time. I mean, we have a whole national holiday in the United States, Thanksgiving, which is sort of, you know, dedicated to overeating. So overeating is when you're just like, oh, that was so good, I couldn't stop, I just ate so much, but oh, it was so worth it, kind of a thing. Binging is when you are using food to resolve something psychological. So, and a binge is an enormous quantity of food, unlike something that you'd normally eat. Like, it's not, a binge is not five cookies. A binge is, you know, 15 cookies or the box, something like that. And when you eat until you're uncomfortably full, as you are saying, what you may be doing is converting physical pain to emotional. So I would be wondering, what is making you uncomfortable at night? And by the way, listeners, I and Christina, on my website, Win the Diet War, I have a giveaway, something you can download, and it's called After Dinner Survival Guide, How to Get Through the Night Without Binging. So that will go more into detail. So Christina, if you were to think about what happens at night that's different than during the day.
Right, absolutely. And at first I used to think, oh, I'm not eating enough during the day, which might also be playing a little bit into it. But I do feel I usually get very anxious and stressed in the evenings, just automatically for as long as I think I can remember, including my childhood. And upon reflection, I really feel it might have to do with the fact that growing up in my family, the dinner time and dinner table was not a relaxing, enjoyable experience. That was when, unfortunately, we might be criticized for like a B in school or whatever the case may be. And I grew up in an environment where there was some verbal and physical abuse. And I'm starting to think my anxiety and uncomfortableness is related to that, and that's starting to help. However, I'm in such a habit of still eating a lot in the evenings, and like I said, it's a little disconcerting because I've actually been about the same weight since I was 15. I'm in my 40s. That's why I never gave it any thought other than like, oh man, this really is uncomfortable. I'm eating too much. And I think maybe it's so ingrained in me, it's just going to take time to continue to work through it and revisit the issues in my childhood.
Well, there's whatever was going on in your childhood, and then there's what's going on now. So if it's a habit that's designed to help you resolve something currently. But what is that? So you mentioned that night times growing up were really painful and difficult, and maybe that's the time when the most abuse happened?
Yes.
Would you say? Okay. So on some level, your unconscious or some part of you correlates the nighttime with danger or abuse or why don't you tell me if you could talk about it, the uncomfortable feeling more specifically, is it anxiety?
So in response, as a young girl, and I happened to have a father whom I loved dearly, but he was a large man, and I would feel, since there was a lot of screaming, and punching of walls and other things, I was very scared. I was scared. I was fearful. And I felt like I couldn't live up to whatever it was the standards were that were being held for me, no matter what I did and no matter how hard I tried and no matter how successful I was. So my emotions were, I don't even remember anger. It was just more fear and being scared.
Okay, so what's happening? And by the way, I saw that someone just tried to call in. Just so you guys know, I can only take one call at a time. So if you want to call in, wait until I'm done with this call, the call that I'm on, and then call me, because I would love to talk to you, and I'm glad you guys are calling. Okay, so Christina, it sounds as if this was a time when you were so vulnerable and had no protection, and the world was scary, and it was a dark, literally and figuratively, kind of time at night. Night became scary, night became anxiety-producing, anything could happen. And even though you're now an adult in your 40s, the part of you that felt that feeling as a child gets kind of activated or awakened at night.
Yes.
Yes. And then you don't have the words. Oh, there's someone else. Person who's calling, please call me back in a few minutes. I have no way to add the calls to like a queue. So sorry, you guys.
Oh, sure.
So the key is to absolutely learn how to respond to that anxiety from a place of your adult self, because what you're doing is getting trapped in the child feelings at night. And
right. And yes, go ahead.
And you also need to I'm sure that you have done, sounds like you've done some work on this, but to even more so grieve what happened to you so that you can grow that little girl who felt abused and scared, grow her up and not feel so paralyzed at night.
Right. And the word that stuck out was grieve, because I feel I also grew up in a household where emotions were shunned and looked upon as being a weakness. So when you say grieve, I'm thinking it sounds obvious. Like, for example, if someone passes away, you grieve. But I'm like, huh, how do you grieve about that? So it's really interesting. I'm just going to have to sit with that. And instead of pushing it away, whether it is through food or exercise or getting involved in something academic, is that what you're meaning by grieving? Just learning how to tap into my emotions a little
yes.
bit better.
Yes. And you were, Ooh. And you were, I heard you say that you were taught that feelings are weak. And so you're
yes.
gonna, even though you may intellectually know that is not the case, there's still maybe a part of you that feels it anyway. And so feeling those feelings may make you feel weak. And so all of this is very uncomfortable, right? It's very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And what you're doing is kind of unbeknownst to yourself, you are creating a sense of physical uncomfortableness as a
yeah,
way of expressing, yes, expressing the, you know, the emotional discomfort. So working through and processing and grieving that past and being able to respond to yourself in words, you know, what do you say to a person who's scared? Who's scared and feels vulnerable. That's how you talk to yourself.
Right, right. And that's going to, I liked what you were saying about speaking positively to yourself, because I'm also someone who is very critical, and so I'm trying to stop that inner critic and turn it around and be more positive. But like you said, be curious and not critical. So I'm working on it. I still think I'm curious and critical, but I'm still working on it.
Well, practice makes progress. So keep working
yeah.
on it, and thank you so much for calling, for being my first
yeah.
caller. And
yes.
Feel free to call again.
Absolutely. Thanks so much, Dr. Nina.
You're
loving
welcome.
Your show so far.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, I know a couple of people were trying to call in while I was talking to Christina. Now would be the time to call back. Until you do, let me just go back to Dyla and the guy who told her, hey, you're not even sweating. It's supposed to hurt. And she thought, he's totally right. Why am I afraid to work hard? And then she said, I think this ties in with my weight and the house. Like, I have a defeatist attitude. Just writing this, she said, just writing this has made me realize how little I believe in my ability to succeed. Well, Dyla, it sounds as if you're already on the right track, because you're connecting three things: your home environment, your difficulty putting in effort, and your lack of belief in your ability to succeed. Oh, there's a call. Hold on. Hi there. This is Dr. Nina. Who am I talking to?
Yeah, this is Lorenzo Yu. How are you?
Hi, Lorenzo. I'm well. How are you?
Good, good. Glad you have your show. It's very necessary and appreciated. I do have a question. You know, I believe in looking at my past to deal with what's eating at me. I really believe in that model. I buy into it completely, but I also believe in willpower, full-on willpower. What's wrong with doing both at the same time, or are they mutually exclusive?
Well, how do you define willpower?
Suck it up and do it. I mean, like Nike, they made $1 billion out of it. Just do it. I've had mixed results, to say the least, but what's wrong with boosting what I understand from studying and processing my past with putting it over the top of willpower or,
well,
you know.
Just do it doesn't sound to me like willpower. It sounds to me, I mean, I see what you're saying, but I would say if you were to say, okay, you can do this, that would be encouraging, and I'd be all for that. Just do it.
Mm-hmm.
But just do it, suck it up and do it. That is critical. So, and I also want to say just one thing about the past. It's not so much that the past is, it's not so much about the past. It's about how the past makes itself known in the present. Kind of like Christina, who I was just talking to, who in the present is experiencing her past. So it's not enough for her to be like, just remember, willpower, just remember that you're in the present and just deal with it. Just don't eat until you're uncomfortable. That would do her no good, because ultimately that's like, you know, picking a weed instead of getting to the root. You got to get to the root. Now, you're defining willpower as, I mean, there's nothing wrong with willpower as long as it's encouraging and you're simultaneously looking at why.
Yeah, what my definition of willpower, as I listen to you, is kind of punitive, like, you know, get up off your keister and do it, or I'm going to criticize you more going back 50 years, if you know what I mean.
Mm. Yeah, that perpetuates the past. That voice of what you're calling willpower sounds kind of mean.
No. Mm-hmm. Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
No, you go ahead.
Well, it's sort of like willpower is meant to be the engine, but all it is a parking brake that I'm putting on and just burning my transmission instead of just going forward. Maybe just let go of that and deal with the reasons behind that punitive message.
Oh, my God. Lorenzo, I'm actually writing this down. Willpower is meant to be the engine, but instead it's the parking brake.
I have PayPal.
That is fabulous. I love that. So really the true engine is encouragement. Would you say that to anybody else? Anyone else who is struggling with something? Would you just say, "Oh, you know, just do it. Get off your keister and do it."
Yeah, I've had horrible bosses who have said that, but the good ones never have. Looking back on it, they've been encouraging, or they let me fix mistakes on my own. They don't act like the inner dad. And like I said, the real bad ones were. And they didn't get anything out of me.
Yeah, it's interesting because bosses often register in our psyche as parents. So and coworkers become siblings. So when you go into a workplace situation, often you see like who is the good boy trying to get the pat on the back from the boss, and who is the competitive sibling who's, you know, always trying to one up the coworker just like he or she did in childhood, and all of these patterns get repeated, and it can get very sticky.
It's the second family, 8 hours a day, and I guess all those games play out. If you have a fully grown-up boss instead of a child in an adult body, you don't have those games. You have productivity.
And the key is to be the boss of yourself. I have my 9-year-old daughter went through a phase where she was like, "You're not the boss of me. You're not the boss of me." I'm like, you're the boss of yourself, and you need to be a good boss. So how are you, if you're the boss of yourself, Lorenzo, how do you encourage yourself?
Lately I've been meditating, and I just stop and let the engine idle, so to speak. And if I do that, I can leave the parking brake off and just idle forward slowly without any gas. And this is good practice to get up to speed. If I my regular modus operandi has always been to punch the gas while I punch myself in self-criticism, and that just leads to an overheated engine. So of late, I'm learning how to do it the right way, with a lot of help.
Well, you sound like you're really putting a lot of thought into this. You sound very reflective, and you're seeking to understand why you do what you do. And that internalized boss, that internalized critic, can be very sneaky, as it was with you. Like, it's willpower, it's motivating. No, it's not. I'm so glad you called, because a lot of people have that idea of, like, you know, just do it. But there's a difference between waking up every morning and being like, I will be good. I will not eat that. I will only eat that. I will not eat that. And just having that willpower and that sort of slave driver in your head all day, it's horrible. Mm-hmm. Who wants that? You want to wake up every day and be like, what am I going to do today? And, okay, this is what I'll have for breakfast because that's what I feel like today. And it doesn't mean that I'm good and it doesn't mean that I'm bad. It's liberating. I call my program Win the Diet War because it's a battle between parts of yourself. But when you win it, you really liberate yourself, and then you can just live your life without constantly having to think about every calorie, fat gram, or carb. And it sounds like you're well on your way.
It's starting to come together. I my brain gets it. I think my taste buds and stomach will hopefully sooner than later.
Well, you know, you have to first recognize what is whatever food you're turning to. What's it doing for you? If you do not have another way of responding to yourself that works, you're going to keep doing what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But as you cultivate a new way of responding, like you're talking about meditating and just being more curious and kinder to yourself, that takes over. And then that, it's easy to replace food mm-hmm. with a new way of relating to yourself.
Right. It's not a new diet. It's a new self-view, which makes diets moot, I guess.
Exactly. Exactly.
Okay.
Look, diets work as long as you're on them, but you cannot stay on them, and they keep you focusing on the wrong thing, which is food. So,
right.
Lorenzo, it sounds like you have everything you need to kind of continue to reflect and cultivate a kinder attitude towards yourself, and you know, keep me posted.
I will certainly do that. Thank you much. And if you can repeat real quick, once I get off the phone, something about eating at night, a survival guide that another caller mentioned. That's really helpful.
It's if you go to my website, which is winthedietwar.com, mm-hmm. I have a giveaway. You'll see a pop-up, and it's you just enter your name and email address, and I will send you a guide called the After Dinner Survival Guide, How to Get Through the Night Without Binging. And I help you understand all the different ways that of why you're binging at night and what to do about it, too.
Yeah, I found that duct tape on the mouth hasn't worked, so I'll sign up.
Lorenzo, you gave me great, great car metaphors, and that was very funny.
Okay, good. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Oh, duct tape on the mouth doesn't work. Oh, he's a funny guy. Okay. All right. So getting back to Dyla, here's the thing. Here's the thing about clutter in your house. I find that having clutter in your house can be correlated with feeling messy on the inside. And I find that many people, when they start making substantive changes on the way that they relate to themselves, they start coming in, and they're like, oh, yeah, you know what? Oh, by the way, I cleaned up my garage. Or, oh, you know what? I just suddenly, like, I just decided it was time. I cleaned up my closet, cleaned up my bathroom. They just start telling me, as we're cleaning out these old ideas they have about themselves, these old notions that do not serve them, they start kind of decluttering their actual homes. And on the other side of the coin, a need, sometimes a compulsive need to be super neat, can be a way of denying internal messiness and kind of sanitizing difficult, messy feelings. But, Dyla, it sounds as if you also may have a fear of things going well, and that is in the category of fear of success. And it's usually one of two things. Either you don't feel as if you deserve happiness, or you're afraid that if you allow yourself to be happy, or if you achieve some kind of success, it's going to be taken away from you. So your question is really a perfect lead-in to my topic today, which is how to stop the sabotage when it comes to weight loss. Now, what do I mean by sabotage? Maybe you're always on a diet, but you never quite reach your goal weight. Or you get to a healthy weight and it's impossible to maintain it. Then some kind of sabotage is happening. So to break the cycle, you have to identify the underlying emotions and conflicts that are the reason you're sabotaging your goals. And as you can see from the callers, Christina thought that she knew that it wasn't about food, but she was eating until she was uncomfortable. Something was going on with her, and now she has a clue as to what that is. With Lorenzo, he had this pull towards an internal, mean boss or critic. So I'm going to guess he probably had a parent who was also kind of mean. So you got to figure out what's going on inside. Because logically and rationally, there are always good reasons to lose weight. And you know the reasons you want to lose weight. And it's not always appearance. It could be health related. Maybe, you don't want to have diabetes, or maybe you have sleep apnea. Maybe you want to lower your risk of a heart attack. Maybe you just want to exercise without getting winded. Or maybe you just want to wear a swimsuit in public without feeling self-conscious. So there are lots of logical reasons to lose weight, but we are not ruled by logic. Often the biggest influence on our behavior are the thoughts and beliefs that are unconscious, which means out of awareness, but not out of operation. Or as I like to say, it is not logical. It is psychological. Okay, so the first step is to identify what prevents you from reaching or staying at a healthy goal weight. Again, by working through these underlying fears and anxieties, you free yourself from them. You know what? It is a lot easier. I'm not going to lie. I'm telling the truth here. It is a lot easier to focus on food. It is a lot easier to count calories and fat grams and carbs. That is much easier than dealing with difficult, painful thoughts and feelings from your past and your present. But, anything worth doing is difficult. So, the first reason people sabotage their weight loss efforts is fear of impulsivity. So let me tell you about Jane. Now, Jane lost the same 30 pounds over and over and over. She'd start a diet. She would show impressive dedication and willpower. Lorenzo, she had willpower. She stuck to her meal plan. She exercised like an Olympic athlete. And she'd lose at least 30 pounds, sometimes more. But the minute she hit her goal weight, she celebrated with ice cream. And this celebration continued until she gained back all the weight. And then she'd start another diet, and the cycle would repeat and repeat and repeat. So when Jane began treatment, her goal was to stop sabotaging herself and start having better willpower. But clearly, the problem was not willpower. Jane proved she had impressive willpower every time she went on a diet. The problem was Jane's fear, unbeknownst to her, of what would happen when she reached her goal weight. So when I suggested this, Jane looked at me like I was totally crazy. Like she was certain that if she lost weight and kept it off, that she would be happier, healthier. She'd wear her skinny jeans. Life would be great. So I said, well, if your mind was not occupied by dieting, what would you be thinking about? And we talked about this for some time until one day Jane blurted out, if I'm thin, I'm afraid I'm going to leave my husband, she said. Impulsivity. So Jane was stuck in a difficult marriage. As long as her weight remained the main problem in her life, she didn't focus on her marital issues. When she recognized and addressed the problems in her relationship, she finally lost weight for good. So her weight was a symptom of the problem, was not the real problem. By addressing the actual problem, her relationship with her husband, Jane no longer needed constant dieting and obsessing over her weight as a distraction from the problem. So here's some things to think about. I'm just going to throw them out for your, food for thought for your consideration. What do you think would be different if you lost weight? What would you be focused on if you were not thinking about your weight or food? And if you are not disappointed or upset with yourself because of your weight, who or what would you be disappointed in? And what are you afraid will happen if you start acknowledging these feelings? Disappointment, upset, all of that kind of stuff. Something to think about. Again, the call-in number is 818-602-4929. For anyone else who would like to talk to me, otherwise I am going to go on to the reason two, second reason for sabotage. It's fear of being an object. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about Willow. Willow had the pretty face syndrome. You know, people were always saying like, oh, she had such a pretty face, and if she just lost weight, guys would line up around the block. The truth was, I mean, like, let's face it, some guys actually prefer curvy, voluptuous, plus-size women. So it was actually totally possible for Willow to find a guy who liked her just as she was. She did not have to lose weight to get a guy. But she didn't try to find a guy. She didn't even look. Now, why not? So Willow grew up watching her mother submit to her stepfather on everything. Her mother was powerless to make basic household decisions, and she had to justify everything she bought to her husband. So Willow got the idea, understandably, that marriage and relationships meant giving in to the needs and wishes of the other person. As long as she remained heavy, her weight protected her from the kind of male attention that might lead to dating, and she feared that she would lose herself in a relationship and just become a girlfriend or a wife, give up her sense of self, just be more of a thing than a person. So as Willow processed this fear, she began to date for the first time in her life, and she was in her upper 20s, late 20s. And when her size no longer served the purpose of protecting her from conflict, she was actually able to lose weight, ironically. And also, just another thing about being an object, for people who have been abused, especially physically abused or sexually abused, the danger of being objectified is even more intense. Their weight often serves as a shield to protect them from other people. One of my patients, at the time she was 13 years old, and when she said this, it was so poignant, and it just broke my heart. It kind of, it moves me even when I think about it now. What she said to me was, bad things don't happen to fat girls. So if you've had experiences with intimacy, whether you got negative messages about closeness or you were abused, bad experiences with intimacy, I should say, you may be afraid of being treated as a body or a thing rather than as a person. And as you work through those fears, you can start feeling more confident and feel good about being attractive instead of scared. So here are some things to think about as far as this fear goes. What makes you afraid of sexual or romantic attention? What are your associations to intimacy, to closeness, and to being in a relationship? And what do you fear will happen if you actually do get into a relationship? Okay, now, the third reason for people sabotaging their weight loss efforts may surprise you. It's a fear of... Dun, dun, dun. That was my drum roll. That didn't work very well. Okay. A fear of happiness. Now, a few years ago, there was a Special K commercial that asked viewers, what will you gain when you lose? Now, let me be really, really, really clear. I fundamentally oppose the idea that you can gain happiness by losing weight, as happiness and enjoyment of life are not tied to the number on the scale. But if you are putting your life on hold by telling yourself you'll be happier once you lose weight, then maybe, just maybe, you could be afraid to be happy. And this might sound crazy to you. You might be like, what? What? I'm miserable right now. Of course I'd be happier if I lost weight. Duh. But if you dig a little deeper, you might discover some anxieties attached to happiness. Maybe you're afraid to be quote-unquote too happy, in case it's taken away from you, the rug pulled out from under your feet, as if by daring to be happy, you're inviting punishment from the universe. As long as you're not too happy, whatever that is, that happiness can't be taken away from you. So you may be afraid that you will lose happiness, and the answer to that is, well, don't be happy, then you can never lose it, which again does not make sense logically, but it does psychologically. It could be you attach a positive meaning to struggling, to unhappiness. True artists must suffer, or it's noble to suffer, it makes you a better person. This notion suggests that you're a good person if you suffer and a bad person if you embrace joy and happiness. And you might also think you don't deserve to be happy, that you're supposed to suffer, because on some level you think you're not a good person or there's something wrong with you, and so you don't let yourself ever feel too good. As long as your weight is a problem to you, you're in a place of comfortable suffering. And Dyla, this might be something you can relate to. So things to think about if this sort of resonates with you. Why are you afraid that happiness can't last? Are there any exceptions to that idea in your own personal history? Have there been times when you were happy and the rug was not pulled out from underneath your foot? What makes you think that suffering is noble? A lot of us get the message that suffering is noble because people who are rich are kind of labeled as, oh, those people are, you know, they're bad people, or they're arrogant, or they're this or they're that, and all these kind of ideas about rich people. And although no one is actively saying, and if you're poor and you suffer, you're a good person, it's sort of a covert message that a lot of people get. Also ask yourself, what is wrong with enjoying life? What is wrong with loving and being loved? What is wrong with being happy? What is scary about that? Again, we have only a few more minutes, so if you have a question, please save it for next week when I will be back, and looking forward to sharing more of my ideas with you. I have one more to go over, which is fear of expectation, but you know what? I think I'm going to save that and talk about it another time. Basically, it's the last one. Another one is fear of expectation and fear of failure. So just briefly, let me go to another question, which is, what's the best way to deal with food triggers? Okay, well, most people know about emotional eating, and they're often aware that it's not what they're eating that's the problem, it's what's eating at them, but sometimes it's difficult to figure out what is going on. So here are some reasons you might be turning to food for emotional reasons. One, you're upset, you're sad, you're angry, you're frustrated. You need to express these feelings in words, not with food. And by the way, when I say that, I do not mean express it to the person who's making you feel that way. You're not going to go up to your boss and say, listen, buddy, you're really pissing me off. Just the thought of seeing you every morning just about makes me physically ill. You're not going to say that, because that would get you fired. That's no good. But you can allow yourself to acknowledge and validate those feelings to yourself or to a friend. And that means actually feeling them. And this is a point I think is important, because there's a difference between what I call thinking your feelings and feeling them. The difference sounds like this. Thinking your feelings is, I'm really angry, I'm really quite upset, I really hate my boss. That's thinking your feelings. Feeling them is saying, oh, I'm so mad, I'm so pissed, I hate my boss. Right? One just doesn't get you anywhere. It's a totally intellectual exercise. And the other will help you get those feelings out. Because you know what? There's only one way to get rid of feelings, as counterintuitive as it may sound. The only way to get rid of feelings is to actually feel them. And we'll talk about this more in later weeks. For now, thank you so much for joining me today. I am here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Pacific here on LA Talk Radio to give you the skinny on weight loss without dieting. And I'd love to hear from you. So call in or send a message on Twitter or Facebook with any questions that you'd like me to cover on the show. Thank you so much, and see you next week.
You're listening to The Dr. Nina Show with Dr. Nina Savelle-Rocklin, only on LA Talk Radio.